Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 coming to you from that conference in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin, at Kalahari Resort. They have a fabulous indoor water park that I understand we will all partake in tonight. Have you been?
Yes, I have. 2 years ago, I came here and participated in the water park.
I love how we're like making it like we participated in the water sports.
Well, there's a float-up bar and everything as well, too, and some of the higher water slides I've ever been on. So it was actually a pretty good time.
I will say, and I don't want you to picture this, but there was a lot of dudes in the hot tub. And, like, the broth was something fierce.
Yeah. It was an interesting experience. We'll put it that
way. Well, I'm here with Matthew Renzi. We've talked several times.
Yeah.
Tell us about yourself, bud.
So I'm an independent software consultant. I've got about 16 years of professional experience building like large-scale data-driven desktop server and cloud-based applications. Double degrees in computer science and philosophy, minor in economics, and my focus was on artificial intelligence and machine learning,
like you.
And I also Microsoft MVP and an ASP insider, as well as an international public speaker. And I've worked on some pretty cool open source software projects.
So you know stuff.
Yes, I know a little bit of stuff.
So let's talk about the stuff you're talking about here.
Okay. So at that conference, which is this conference,
yeah.
I'm speaking on clean.
We have to do that joke every time.
I'm speaking on clean architecture patterns, practices, and principles. So the idea is that there's been a series of modern kind of architectural, I don't know what to call them other than patterns, practices, and principles that have emerged over the last few years that have kind of changed the way a lot of us are thinking about our architectures. Things like domain-centric architectures, CQRS, microservices, and functional organization. Things that we didn't really think about when we were dealing with the traditional three-layer database-centric architecture.
Okay.
But now is really changing and cleaning up a lot of our architectures in ways that I think are really good. And so I'm trying to get the word out about these ideas to get people reading the books from the experts that are essentially coming up with these ideas so that we can start incorporating them in our day-to-day practices rather than fighting with the old traditional, CRUD application, three-layer database-centric enterprise architecture.
So let's just say, I'm Sue Dev, and obviously Sue is very competent, and she's like, I want to have clean coding practice.
Yep.
How does she... And she wants to do this, and what are some things that she can do, Sue Dev, to sort of start along that way you can't, economically speaking, rebuild an entire thing.
Yeah. So there's certain things that you could do with like a greenfield project and certain things you could do with a brownfield project.
Right.
So a new project or a project that you've been working on already and is probably possibly beyond being able to refactor it from an architectural standpoint. Some of the things, like if you're starting with a new architecture, essentially you'd be doing things like if it's a complex domain, and obviously all these things are very context dependent, but if you have a relatively complex domain, inverting the dependencies so that rather than having your database be the center of the architecture, you're using the domain as the center of the architecture because it works really well with embodying the objects and the use cases of the application to keep things mirroring the mental models of the users so that everybody on the team can easily understand things with things like domain-driven design. Like that works really well with the domain-centric architectures. In addition, using application layers in order to embed the high-level use cases as executable code. That's something that we typically just threw all this stuff in a business logic layer in the old three-layer database-centric architectures, but in these more modern architectures, we're separating these things out and keeping our abstractions depending upon things in the right way. In addition, with CQRS, you can do things like have your command stack and your query stack be separate because there's a significant amount of benefits to separating these things in terms of the way you reason about the software, and more importantly, things like performance, being able to query the database extremely fast versus the writes are typically slower. And this is by orders of magnitude, but because we do orders of magnitude more reads from a database than writes to a database, this actually makes a lot of sense economically.
Sure. So pretend I'm Sue Dev, right?
Okay. Yep, yep.
And I mean, I understand what you're saying. Here's all these architectural patterns that you want to do. Like, I want to do it, but how do I brownfield move stuff over? Because I feel like a lot of us devs, we sort of inherit this code and we're like, I feel dirty, let's clean it. What are some things that I can do? The first thing you said that was interesting to me is that put the domain at the center.
Yep.
How do I start doing that piecemeal?
So with a brownfield development, I don't know that this would be the right approach to it. However, if you do have giant monoliths in a brownfield environment, you have the ability to horizontally partition them at what we call bounded context into microservices. And there's a lot of debate as to whether what the granularity of these microservices should be. From my own personal experience and having conversations now with numerous experts on it, aligning these microservices to what we call bounded context seems to work best. So you've got a giant application with several of these bounded contexts inside.
Okay.
And and maybe I should explain bounded context for people that might not know.
Sure.
A bounded context is essentially a boundary within which specific models are valid. So, for example, you've got a sales and support kind of things. On the sales side, salesperson is a support person on the support side, which you just call an employee. So when you start overlapping these various models, they become invalid in other contexts, or it becomes progressively more difficult to maintain them as a unified single domain.
Got it.
So we separate these things out into these separate bounded contexts, and we use microservices in order to encapsulate these things. So you take this monolithic application, and you start looking at pieces of it that you could decompose and pull off of the monolith, and then convert into a microservice that has its own consistent database, its own kind of consistent object model, and is relatively simple by comparison because you no longer have exponential increases in complexity with this giant
sure.
monolith system, and start pulling these pieces off one at a time in order to reduce the complexity, encapsulate things. I mean, there's numerous benefits, but obviously this is all context dependent as well, too.
Sure.
It's got to be the right application to do it on, the right teams to do it on, and the right set of constraints with the environment within which these microservices will operate.
So you're saying that if you have a brownfield application and you want to go to sort of a clean architecture, you can look at sort of breaking chunks off a bit at a time if you want to go microservices.
Yep.
I have been told, and I love your opinion, that a long time ago I was doing an algorithms class.
Yep.
And he said there is a way to sort faster than n log n.
Okay.
But you have to have like a bajillion records.
Okay.
And he was like, but as a computer person, never try shooting a fly with a shotgun.
Gotcha.
And sometimes I feel like this microservices discussion, it feels like the architecture of microservices is like a huge shotgun.
Yep.
When do I start to, when should I be like, okay, my application is a fly, so I should be careful. When do I know the size scale for that?
And I'm definitely in agreement with you. The more and more I've talked to experts and the more I've heard horror stories about microservices projects failing for a number of different reasons, the more it's occurred to me that the advice to start everything as a single application and only convert it into microservices when the pain of dealing with that you know single application becomes greater than the cost of the microservices overhead. And so that spot for me, almost every time I've implemented this now, has been that bounded context. Essentially, every time we start having multiple models that have different overlapping bounded contexts and we try cramming it into a single application, we start pulling it apart. And once you start pulling those apart, I mean, it reduces the overall complexity, your development. I mean, everything seems to work out significantly better. But I don't know if this is the right advice, but you just don't want to start with a set of microservices right off the bat. You want to start with single applications, test things out, and then start splitting it apart when you hit those bounded contexts.
So let's just say we're at the fly level.
Okay.
What are some things that I can do in a greenfield application to feel good about like having the ability to move forward if that were to be a change I need to make?
A lot of it, in my opinion, is running experiments, trying different experiments, and then deferring the difficult decisions until later. Essentially, the longer you defer a decision, the more information you have, and the ability to make a good decision increases if you look at the cone of uncertainty, essentially.
Sure.
It increases as we get closer and closer to the end of the project, essentially. So by deferring these difficult decisions until later in the game, oftentimes you can actually keep your software and your architecture extremely flexible and then implement these architectural patterns and practices and principles when it finally is necessary to do so.
I
so
see.
Essentially starting and evolving the application architecture over time. Now, this doesn't always work. There's certain constraints that are going to make this impossible to defer these decisions.
Of course.
And there's often a lot of architects that would argue, no, this is terrible advice. We need to have the architecture all set out and ready to go and then fill in the pieces afterwards. Pros and cons to these both equally reasonable ways of building software.
You know, and you've done these. I make demoware, ladies and gentlemen. And so this is a gentleman that makes stuff. But for engineers like us, and I had an engineer get mad at me. He's a civil engineer. He's like, you're not an engineer. You certified with the state. And he had a good point because...
Yeah.
Right, I'm not, but he didn't have a good point because you're not going to go to an engineer and say, hey, I know you're 3/4 of the way done, but we need this bridge to be upside down.
Yeah.
But they will do that to us every day.
If building software was like building a house, those things would apply. But you know the metaphor of building software as a house breaks down pretty quickly. What we're building is extremely complex in a wildly changing dynamic environment with markets with high degrees of uncertainty, user preferences that change as we're building the software. As they learn how to use the software, things are changing as well, too. It's just a high degree of uncertainty with a lot of the software we're writing. Now, if you're building, say, an ATM machine, something that we've done numerous times before, and we're just going to build the next version or next ATM machine, you probably wouldn't start using these highly agile, highly emergent architecture practices. Mm-hmm. You'd probably start with something more, okay, here's the box and here's the stuff we need to do in that box now. But when you're building software like the next Uber, essentially you have no idea what you're building, how it's going to scale, and all of these various things. So you build something small and simple that, that solves the initial problem, validates the kind of market risks and stuff like that, and then figure out scaling beyond that. But it's I think when you get to that scaling part is where these architectural patterns, practices, and principles really
and
kick
I think,
in.
I think we're, like, I love the way you're saying this because it feels like we have two competing things. There's the making things right and the making things work.
Yep.
And both of those are competing. And so what you're telling, and let's see, I'm a Sue Dev, right? And I'm the first thing I want to do is I want to know what problem am I solving and then just solve it.
Yeah. So in the world of software architecture, context really is king. And so all of these things are highly dependent upon the specific context in which you're building this architecture and building this application. So once again, like using the Uber metaphor, essentially figuring out, teasing out risk early on is way more important than building the right thing first. Now, if you're building that ATM machine that we've done numerous times and we kind of know the patterns and practices for, essentially the risk of building this thing isn't very great. So the context dictates that, well, that we should build it using these kind of predefined architecture ideas, as opposed to the Uber over here, which is like we need to iterate very rapidly and have this emergent architecture kind of evolve over time. And it's not to say that we're deferring all decisions. It's essentially we're deferring decisions until the right time to make them, which oftentimes is a bit further down the road than most people would feel comfortable with.
And some may argue, doesn't that deferment by necessity introduce technical debt?
Yes, it's technical debt, but if you look at the technical debt quadrant, there's essentially acceptable types of technical debt, and then there's kind of unacceptable types, and then there's stuff that's kind of okay.
Fuzzy.
Yeah, fuzzy, if you will. And so this is an acceptable type of technical debt in most people's eyes because we've consciously made the decision, knowing the cost in the long term, to make this deferment, recognizing that we're reducing risk overall, and if the cost of the risk, you know, the likelihood of something not being right, and then the cost is greater than the risk of the deferment, I think I worded that wrong, but essentially then we make the decision to defer this decision until later. And there's some really good examples of people deferring decisions that most people would think were crazy. For example, well, let's build the database. No, let's just write the stuff to the file system for now until we've got this minimum viable product that we know works, and then we'll figure out how to build it in a relational database model later. They deferred it later, and pretty soon they're like, wow, we've built the whole application, and we're just using simple, you know, plain JSON text files for our storage.
Which argues for a document database,
yes,
as opposed to if you would have stuck to that relational
absolutely.
Model, you would have been hosed.
Yep, you would have switched to the relational model, been stuck in that, and then the context around you, the world of cloud computing, introduced this whole document store database thing, and now, that's the perfect solution. But because we deferred it, the markets, the technology, the preferences changed, and now it maps perfectly to what we're doing.
So this is the first time I've heard the term technical debt quadrant. Is it a thing? What is
that? Yeah, was that, I think it was Martin Fowler, but I'd have to look at the article to remember for sure. And Martin Fowler, I believe, coined the term technical debt. I think he elaborated it on when he built the technical debt quadrant. It's really interesting because it helps clarify a lot of the ambiguity with the term technical debt, because a lot of people immediately have a negative connotation with it. But much like actually taking on debt for a business, there's good debt and there's bad debt. If you're making an investment in the company because you've recognized the risks and you've recognized the cost of the interest over time and what you're going to gain if this pans out, that's good technical debt. But if you are just spending money willy-nilly, not recognizing like how you're ever going to pay the interest on it, I mean, that's bad technical debt.
And I like that analogy because I think, like, when we have this file new blank page sort of paralysis, we worry so much about all the risks without actually quantifying the risks, quantifying the positives, and saying which ones can we live with and which ones can we live without, and then just choosing and saying, I'm okay with it.
Well, and that's why I think taking a highly experimentational approach to this kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. If you make a whole bunch of small mistakes and you have a whole bunch of small failures because you've run a series of these really small experiments, the overall cost isn't all that great.
Sure.
But it's when you make these giant decisions with minimal information that you get yourself trapped in an architectural kind of nightmare.
Sure.
So I highly advocate just taking small experiments or using small experiments to tease out these ideas and see what's working and what's not working. And then you eventually kind of gradually work your way towards the right answers.
And these experiments may or may not pan out, but because you've made them small enough, that the risk is not as high.
And that's the trick. So the cost of the experiments is relatively low, but the amount of learning that we get from running these experiments is extremely high. So we're teasing things out very early on, and we're reducing risk, which especially with these kind of small software startups working in uncertain environments, risk is the single biggest like danger. It's it's not whether we're building the right thing right now, or I'm trying to think of how to word this correctly. It's not the same kind of constraints you'd be dealing with like in an enterprise organization, right, building a CRM system or something that we know understand relatively well.
Well, not only that, but you may have years to finish.
Yes. Yeah.
You may your funding window may run out in 2 months.
Yeah. With the small software startups, I mean, you're dealing with an entirely different set of constraints than you are with enterprise applications. So.
Well, this has been super helpful. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about where we can go to find out about these things?
So my website, MatthewRenzi.com, has all of the source code. I've got ways to implement the screaming architecture in ASP.NET MVC5. I've got Pluralsight courses, a whole slew of articles, and source code. I open source pretty much everything I do, and all of the presentation materials for all the presentations I give as well.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put some links down at the bottom so you'll be able to find them. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank
it's been
you
really helpful
me.
Because at first you're like telling me all these architects. I'm like, oh gosh. but then you said, look, these are here. But if you're starting here, just have those in mind. But take little bite-sized chunks, experiment, and make your stuff work.
Excellent.
Thanks so much, my friend. Again, we're here in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin, at that conference. It's fantastic. I love it here at the Kalahari. My name is Seth Juarez, Channel 9. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next time.